I didn't either. I studied the rusty liquid in the glass and took a deep breath as I raised it to my lips. Well, I damn well better. Duane continued to watch me, probably amazed that anyone would take a second drink of the water. I got smart this time and just held the glass to my lips and shot a glance at Vic, who covered her mouth for multiple reasons. She turned her head.
Help!
Duane turned to look at her. What? I gratefully placed the glass back into Duane's hand and stepped forward, leaning an ear against the basement door. I'm sure I heard it that time. I twisted the knob as Duane's voice called out from behind me. That door's locked. There's nobody. The door swung open, revealing a stairwell that turned at a landing below and continued to the left. There was a light switch to the right just inside the doorway, and I flipped it on. The full force of heat and humidity wafted up from the basement as I took the first step down. Duane, it sounds like there's somebody in trouble down here, so I'm going to have to look, okay? He moved to the doorway behind me, edging a little in front of Vic. Nuh-uh, there's nobody down there. I raised a hand at his protests. Vic, did you hear something? Maybe. She tromped down the stairs behind me and whispered, what's my motivation? Duane called after us. Hey, there's nobody down there. She just yelled that. As I turned the corner at the landing, I looked back up at her. What, were you going to make me drink the entire glass of water? She smiled the crocodile smile. I just wanted to see if you could do it. There was another light switch attached to one of the basement support poles, and a new reinforced BX cable that strung on into the darkness. I put my hand on the switch as Duane joined us. It appeared the dogs wouldn't come down the stairs. Hey, you can't go down there without a warrant thing! I glanced back up at him. Duane, I've got an emergency situation, and you wouldn't want me to ignore it if someone is down here and hurt, would you? Well, nuh-uh, but... I flipped the switch and glanced around as I stepped onto the dirt floor. It was your usual old house basement with a low ceiling and rough-cut beams and antiquated wiring with porcelain insulators and cast-iron pipes that arrived from above and disappeared below. There was an aged washer and dryer that sat in a corner, unplugged, along with an operating hot water heater and a massive coal-driven furnace looking like a giant metal octopus with a large chute that led to an opening along the hand-stacked foundation. There was the usual junk piled against the walls, along with an inordinate amount of gardening tools, supplies, and at least 8 50-pound bags of fertilizer. A large blue tarp was tacked to the sill above and screwed into a 4x4 resting on the floor with a number of heavy-gauge extension cords disappearing underneath. As we stood there, the air pressure from whatever was on the other side billowed the plastic back toward us. Mick stuffed her hands in the pockets of her jacket and leaned against one of the support beams as Duane joined me, still holding the glass of putrid water. "I don't see any snakes, Duane." They're in the tunnel. I gestured with my chin toward the blue plastic. That way? Yeah, but it's caved in real bad. That's why we've got the tarp over it. I walked to the front of the opening and held my hand to the side, where warm, moist air was escaping. I looked down and saw that two large eyelet bolts were screwed into the 4x4 and then up at two large hooks where the wood could be lifted and held in place. I stooped and, even with the pain in my rear, began lifting up the wood and consequently the tarp. Duane was at my side immediately and placed a hand on my arm. Look, you can't go in there. You gotta have a warrant to be... Duane, I've explained the situation, and if you attempt to interfere with me any more, I'm going to ask my deputy over there to restrain you, and trust me, it's something she really likes doing. I threw a glance back at Vic, who lowered a boot to the floor and began moving toward us, in a smooth but determined gait. Duane threw himself aside and sat on the bags of fertilizer. He was still holding the glass. Fine. Fuck it. Just go ahead and get it over with. I raised the board and hooked it up as Vic joined me at the jagged opening in the basement wall where many a bandit and whoremonger had escaped the local constabulary. There were a few small indicator lamps strung out like landing lights, but that was all. The warmth and humidity hit like a wave, and we both stood there. I couldn't see anything, but thought that there must be a switch somewhere, so I raised a hand past Vic's face and felt along the wall. It was there, and I flicked the heavy-duty toggle and watched as fluorescent lights throbbed on full with a monotone thrum. Vic, as usual, spoke first. "Well, fuck me." We both leaned forward in absolute disbelief. Humidifiers and heaters ran the distance half the length of a football field, with hydroponic lights cascading life-giving warmth and vitamin D onto four-foot-tall plants that grew as far as we could see. I turned my head and spoke out of the side of my mouth. "Is that what I think it is?" She nodded and looked back to where Duane sat at the opening of what looked to be the largest subterranean marijuana crop in history. Chapter 7. When I got back to the office, Vic was stretched out on the reception bench asleep, wrapped in a couple of blankets with a pillow stuffed against the armrest. Dog lay beside the bench and wagged a greeting in 4-4 time as I sat with care next to Vic's stocking feet, the only part of her that showed from under the gray wool. I reached down and petted Dog, who fell over on his side next to Vic's tactical boots, and closed his eyes. It seemed like a really good idea, so I pulled my hat down over my face and leaned back against the wall. Vic moved her feet up onto my lap, and her voice was thick with sleep. "Well, now we know why Duane told Gio that there were snakes in the tunnel." "Yep." I rubbed the thick knitted socks and listened to her purr. "I locked up the cash crop, and Gina has taken command of the household. She says she didn't know anything about Duane's cottage industry."
"Is she the one who works over at the Come and Go, drives around with people tied to her bumper and always smells like the chronic?"
"That'd be the one."
"And you believe her?"
"Let's just say I thought we had enough people in jail for one night. And I've got plenty more problems to go around. Where's Henry?"
She pulled the blanket down, and her nose and the tarnished gold eyes appeared.
"Asleep in your office."
I exhaled, and wasn't sure if I had the energy to fill my lungs back up again. "How is the mad golfer?"
"Resting comfortably in holding cell A."
"And the pot grower of America?"
"Holding cell B."
She adjusted, and I could see she was reaching underneath herself.
"You want some more fucked up shit?"
"Not really." She recovered some loose sheets of paper that she handed to me.
"Too bad, 'cause it's the only news that's fit to print."
I examined the pages. "What's this?"
"The answer from NCIC on Sancho's request for a report on the partial thumb, which came back as a negative. Not enough print to work with."
"It's Felix Polk's. We know that because he's been everywhere in the county asking for it back." I rubbed my face with one hand. "That's another little chore I've got to go do." She wrapped the blanket tighter around the trunk of her body, emphasizing some of her more curvaceous physical attributes.
"Uh-huh."
I looked at her. "Now why do I not like the sound of that?"
"Because I was bored and punched in Felix Polk and discovered he has a bench warrant with the Travis County Sheriff's Department in Texas concerning a failure to appear on a breaking and entering charge stemming from an incident in 1963.
"Is that all?"
She snorted. "Isn't that enough?"
"I don't think a more than 40-year-old bench warrant is going to be enough to occupy the Euskadi Avenger, especially now that we've got a real death on our hands." She laughed outright.
"Yeah, well, imagine how Felix Polk is going to feel about having his past and minor transgressions revisited. And as to Geo Stewart's death, there's not much of a mystery to that one."
"Maybe. Did you happen to notice that one of his shoelaces was undone?" The look she was giving me could have been defined as incredulous.
"So?"
"Geo is pretty careful about that type of thing."
She sat up. "Wait a minute, are we discussing the sartorial splendor of the man whose hair grew through his long underwear?"
"Yep, but he's also the guy who wore both suspenders and a belt and fully laced his logging boots." She covered her head back up with the blanket.
"Right." I sighed and thought about the long drive I was going to have to take up the mountain.
Is that address of Felix Polk current? I was thinking of paying him a little visit before Santo gets to work. You want to tag along?
She didn't move, her head still covered.
No.
I looked at Dog, who dropped his head back between his outstretched paws. So much for man's best friends. I sighed and glanced down the hallway toward the two cells and back.
I don't mean to disturb your rest, but you say Ozzie Jr. is in cell A?
Sleeping like a lamb and snoring like a lion.
Well, it's good that he's getting some rest.
She snuggled back down in her blankets, and I was starting to wish it were a wider bench.
Yeah, imagine how he's going to feel when he wakes up and finds out he's headed for the big house.
Are you Felix Polk?
The bandage on the man's thumb, the registration of the Jeep Wagoneer in the drive, and the name on one of the mailboxes at the end of Caribou Creek Road were pretty good clues, but this was official business. The wind raced over the canyon where we stood, and with the altitude, I bet we were standing in -10 degrees. Felix Polk was a tall man, almost as tall as I am, and close to the same age, with a large belly, but in good shape if you didn't count the missing appendage. He had on a pair of chainsaw chaps and a hard hat with the built-in noise compressors flipped up so that he could hear me. Behind the cabin, some kind of machinery was running.
You haven't got my thumb with you, do you?
I smiled at him. Mr. Polk, that's actually what I'd like to talk to you about. He nodded.
Come on out back and I'll shut the log splitter down.
I followed him around the cabin and noted the architecture. It was pretty indicative of the period when the Bighorn National Forest had to concede a few spots of land to long-term 100-year leases. Some of them were coming up for renewal and were a cause of anxiety to the locals, and the ones that were built in the late 40s and early 50s were recently changing hands for a reasonable amount of money because of the concerns over the state's proclivity to cancel the leases. This one was a handsome structure, the logs weathered to a solid gray with the old Oregon cement in between recently patched. Green asphalt shingles and wooden-cased windows framed the small porch at the front, which led down a shallow slope to a pump house next to Caribou Creek. There were stacks of firewood under every eave of the cabin, and a lean-to behind it held another 8 cords at least. Evidently Felix Polk was expecting the winter to last as long as I was. As nice as the cabin was, it was the environs that were the strong point. The house was nestled into a small box canyon with massive rock walls thrusting above the lodgepole pines. The majority of the privately owned structures in the mountains were situated in clusters along service roads or by the reservoirs such as Dull Knife, but this one was isolated with the only way in or out a dirt road that ran a winding 3/4 of a mile back to Route 16. It was just the kind of place to which you hoped to someday retire. And Felix Polk had. 22 years at Dynamic Tool and Die. Company went belly up, but I had enough scraped together to buy this place. A truck driver who delivered a bunch of salvage equipment to us down in Austin told me about it. He set a cup of coffee in front of me, and I wondered if I dozed off and my nose landed in the mug, if I'd drown. There was a fire burning in the old brick fireplace, and the cabin was cozy and warm. The furnishings looked to be from the 60s, and there were built-in bookcases chocked with a lot of military history and mass-market paperbacks with titles like Death Hunt, Dead Zero, Dead On, and Death Blow. All in all, there was a lot of death on those shelves. The most disconcerting thing was the Nazi flag that hung over the fireplace. Felix Polk caught me looking at it. My father's. Belgium, 1944.
The Bulge?
Yeah, I think he hated the British almost as bad as the Germans. He used to love pointing out that 19,000 Americans died in that battle, and the Brits only lost 200.
More to the point, how many did the Germans lose?
About 100,000 casualties.
I was tired, but felt as if I should make a few stabs at small talk. Besides, the other stab, the bite wound, was keeping me awake.
How long have you had the cabin?
About 7 months now.
He poured himself a cup and sat across the kitchen table from me with a Dynamic Tool and Die mug. It was in pretty bad shape, but I was able to work on it all through the summer. I already burned a lot of firewood living up here, so I got that industrial splitter. I gestured toward his bandage. That how you lost the end of your thumb? He laughed and nodded. Hell yes, pinched it right off. I got my glove caught in the damn thing and didn't even know I'd done it. Felt a little funny, so I pulled my glove off, and damned if the end of my thumb didn't stay in it.
Ow.
Yeah, it got pretty bad. When I went into the hospital over in Sheridan, they stitched it up and gave me some pills. I made the mistake of taking a few of them with a couple of beers and couldn't get off the sofa in there.
Why the hospital in Sheridan?
The one in Durant is closer.
Needed gas for the splitter, and it's cheaper over in Sheridan.
Did they notice that part of it was missing?
Yeah, they asked me about that, and it was then that I remembered that I'd made a run to the dump. I was drinking beer while I was splitting and had that cooler out there, so when I fished the end of my thumb out of my glove, I just put it in and forgot about it.
I glanced around at the general unkempt quality of the cabin and asked, "You have a family, Mr. Polk?" He nodded.
"Used to. Had a wife that died, and I got a daughter, but then she died, and I don't hardly hear from the granddaughter anymore."
He studied me and looked at the ring finger on my left hand.
"You a widower, Sheriff?"
"Yep." He sipped his coffee.
"Kids?"
"Yep, a daughter." He nodded.
"Seems like we've got a lot in common."
I needed to get to the point of my visit.
"Mr. Polk, are you aware that there's a bench warrant for your arrest in Austin?"
He stiffened.
"What?"
I leaned back in my chair. "This is not an official call, Mr. Polk. It's just that one of my deputies ran your name through the database and came up with an outstanding charge of breaking and entering." He was surprised, to say the least, and then outraged.
"From back in the 60s?
1963, actually.
Do you know what that's about?"
In all honesty, I was tired and just didn't care. "Mr. Polk..." He stood with his back to me and then turned to lean against the refrigerator.
"I stole my own truck."
He picked up his coffee cup and poured himself some more, as a little of the outrage left him. He motioned toward me with the pot, but I declined. "I had this international scout that dropped an automatic transmission, and this fellow fixed it, but charged me double. I promised him I'd pay him, but he kept my truck and wouldn't give it back. Well, I had a job to go to, so I broke into the mechanic shop and stole my truck. Got picked up by a deputy 3 days later, spent a week and a half in stir."
"Did you ever pay the bill?"
He puffed up a bit and wouldn't make eye contact with me.
"No.
I figured that with the 10 days I spent in jail, we were even." He shook his head in disbelief and stared at the green swirl linoleum on the kitchen floor.
"Over 40 years ago, and you show up on my doorstep."
"I'm not here to arrest you, Mr. Polk." His eyebrows crouched over his eyes.
"What?"
"As a matter of fact, I'm here to ask a favor concerning your thumb." With the holding cells filled to capacity, I was forced to take a nap in my office, which never works because everybody can find me. "Ruby says to remind you that you have an eye doctor appointment tomorrow morning." I tipped my hat up and looked at Vic, holding a fistful of the post-its that my dispatcher usually left on my door jamb.
"I'm sleeping." I lowered my hat.
"She also says Isaac Bloomfield says Bill McDermott discovered something and wants to talk to you about it." I raised my hat again.
"Discovered something where?"
She sipped her energy drink, and I thought about asking her for some. I could use a little energy. "Something about G.O. Stewart. I called Bloomfield, but he wouldn't tell me." She sorted through the square yellow pieces of paper that represented my personal agenda. "I get the feeling he doesn't like me."
"He likes you fine. He just doesn't like your language."
"Fuck him."
"Uh-huh."
Figuring my nap was over, I put my hat on my desk and pulled my sheepskin jacket down from where I was using it as a blanket.
"Anything else?"
"You were snoring."
"Sorry, it must be my wounds."
I glanced up at the old Seth Thomas clock on my wall. It was still losing about 5 minutes a year. I should be so lucky. It was past lunch. I still hadn't had anything to eat. Dog had consumed both burritos, and I was famished. I'm really hungry. She stood and flipped the post-its onto my desk. "Well, let's go and eat. As far as I know, G.O. Stewart isn't going anywhere." Even though the mercury had yet to break 2 degrees, we walked to the Busy Bee Cafe.
How did the meet with a nine-fingered man go?
I pulled my gloves out and stuffed my fingers into them quickly so as to keep all of my own. He promised to not roam the county in search of his thumb.
In trade for?
His thumb. She shook her head.
Does he really want to make a keychain out of it?
He didn't say. A few of the assessor's office ladies shot out of the back door of the courthouse, and we waited as they passed. I also figured I'd call up the Travis County Sheriff's Department and see if I could get them to drop the charges. The story he told me sounds legit, and I don't think they're going to want to pursue. We rounded the corner of the courthouse. Where is the Basco, anyway?
At the hospital again.
I guess Antonio's got colic.
Yeah, well, at least the critter's got a house to live in.
She seemed distant, and I figured I had to do a little bridge mending. Do you want me to go look at that house with you today?
She walked along the sidewalk that crossed the courthouse's south lawn with her hands stuffed into her coat pockets and her ball cap on her head. She'd obviously seen me admiring the fur hat.
No. I'll really do it this time.
Someone put a higher bid in on it.
I stopped, but she kept walking. Oh. She turned at the top of the stairs that led down to the commercial portion of Main Street, all 2 blocks of it, and looked at me.
My life.
I joined her at the precipice. Yep.
Sucks.
I stood close with my back blocking the wind and looked down at her. How so?
I'm stuck in this one-horse town with this crappy job that doesn't pay shit and an on-again, off-again relationship with my boss.
I nodded. Gee, you're right. Your life does suck. She hit me with an elbow.
It needed wiring, plumbing, and the foundation was going to have to be shored up, and some asshole paid more than the asking price.
We'll find you another one.
I wanted that one.
I'm sorry.
She kept her head down, and I leaned in till the brim of her hat was against my chest. She took a while to respond, and the clouds of her breath billowed up past my face like a rapidly cooling steam bath.
Yeah.
We stood there like that for a while.
Pretty big step, buying a house.
I felt the bill of her hat nod. I figure I'm of an age where I need to start making some decisions in my life.
Am I one of those decisions?
Could be.
She was right. Ours was an on-again, off-again relationship, where the off-again part was mostly my fault. We'd had a smoldering attraction that had bloomed into a stoked furnace ever since an incident in Philadelphia had presented itself. But I still couldn't reconcile the difference in our ages, that we worked together and that only a few months ago her younger brother back in Philadelphia had proposed to my daughter. Look, I know that right now our ages don't make that much of a difference, but 10 years from now...
Fuck 10 years from now!
She looked up at me with those tarnished eyes, and I tried to think about what else I wanted to say. We continued to stare at each other, and as usual, I opted for the path of least resistance. Come on, it's cold. I'll buy you lunch.
I want a house.
She turned, and I followed her down the steps.
Hey, I know. Maybe I could buy Sancho's house.
Henry was back at the office when we returned, and I made him accompany me to the hospital. Durant Memorial had a morgue, or a standard treatment room that served as a morgue. It was room 31, a piece of information that wasn't shared with the common populace. Wouldn't you say this was like finding a hole in a pincushion?
He was injecting himself 3 to 4 times a day to control his glucose levels, but there are 2 things abnormal about these 3 injection points. The location where most of his injections took place is in the normal areas of the body, the front and the outside of the thighs, the abdomen, except the area around the navel, the upper and outer areas of the arms, the area just above the waist on the back, and the buttocks. You'll notice where these injections were made.
Bill McDermott held the junk man's leg up for my inspection. I could see that there were three larger holes which punctured the area behind the knee.
How in the world did you find them?
Blood.
What's number two?
The size of the needle that went in there three times is a lot larger than the one regularly used for insulin, hence the blood.
I studied the young